Good evening to the team for the Better Health Radio Show. Good evening and welcome.
Hi, good evening, Ronnie. How are you?
Grateful and happy to be here, although I'm not happy that the fact that my schoolmate, Greg Effect, Greg Stanceely, is not feeling too well. Would have been perfect for him to be here with the doctors, of course, and then he would get some insight as to why he's not able to come in this evening.
A free consultation. Yeah, a free consultation for Gregson, always, but we wish him a speedy recovery because we know he's a staple here with us and he's very dear to us. So Gregson, if you're listening to us, rest up and we hope to have you again with us next week. I want to extend a warm welcome to our listeners here on the Better Health Radio Show, a show which is aimed at raising public awareness of common health issues that affect us all. I am Dr. Kia Lewis. It is my pleasure this evening to be your host. And as usual, we look forward to your participation. We're going to have a good show for you this evening, something that is topical and maybe something that might not have been on your mind, but you need to be thinking about. Now, this show is not the same without you. And so we want to take this opportunity to remind you that you can contact us with your questions and comments either by calling the station at 434-1790, that's 434-1790, or if you're a little radio shy and you prefer to send through a message, send your WhatsApp messages to 266-4862, that's 266-4862. Now, Ronnie, I should have asked you to play me a feeling hot, because this evening we are going to be talking about heat illness. And I know a lot of people go, what is that, heat illness? But I'm sure that many of us have heard of at least heat stroke or heat rash. But there's actually a collection of illnesses that can be caused by the extreme heat called heat illness. And I thought that this was important to talk about because as we head into summer, I think many of us are wondering if Barbados is being cooked. It's extremely, exceedingly hot, both outside and indoors. And I think it's important for you, our listeners, to know that while we frolic and enjoy the sun, there can be some dire consequences to too much heat. So this evening, we are going to be discussing heat illness. And I want to encourage persons, especially persons that are older, those who have children that are going to summer camps. Many of you that I know are going to be going to the FETs and jumping for cadoumment. This topic is important. I want you to listen to this topic about heat illness this evening. As usual, we like to bring you very qualified persons. And so that's no different this evening. We have with us Dr. Latonya Arthur. Dr. Arthur, welcome to the program.
Good evening and thank you for having me.
Yes. So let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Arthur. She is an emergency physician. She earned her undergraduate medical degree from the University of the West Indies Mona campus in 2010. Post-internship, she worked in hematology and accident and emergency departments at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. In 2022, she successfully completed her postgraduate training in emergency medicine with the University of the West Indies Cato campus. She is currently pursuing a master's in clinical forensic medicine with the Victoria Institute of Forensic Medicine through Monash University, Melbourne, Australia. So it looks like Dr. Arthur, sometime in the future, we're going to have you on to deal with other topics because you're widening your scope. Dr. Arthur is a proud single mother, the founder and director of Gentle Beginnings Daycare. Yes, you heard that right. She's a doctor who also runs a daycare. And she's also the founder of Mobile Doctors. This is a doctor's office. They have a physical plant in Wildey Industrial Park. And they also offer concierge medicine. That's house visits, the common thing that we call house visits. So we want to warmly welcome you, Dr. Arthur, again to our program. So I'm just going to jump right into it now that our guests know a little bit about you. What are heat illnesses? I know there are a lot of people out there going, heat illness? What are we talking about when we talk about heat illnesses?
So I really want to touch on the medical part of it. But one of the things that you would have said before kind of jumped out at me because a lot of the times people mention heat stroke as a thing. You know, I went outside and oh my gosh, it was so hot, I have a heat stroke. But what people may not know is that heat illness is actually a spectrum of disease. It's many different components that start off as something mild and can end up with something life-threatening. And so that's what we call a spectrum of disease. So heat stroke, interestingly, is the life-threatening heat illness that we would experience. The milder form of it would be what we call heat rash or prickly rash. And then there's a spectrum. So from heat rash, you can have something called heat edema. You can have something called heat exhaustion, heat syncope, which means you're fainting, and then heat stroke. So it's a spectrum of disease that medically we look out for when persons are experiencing either hotter than warmer climates or coming in with a very high body temperature.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you explained that it's a spectrum, because like you said, there are things that we are commonly aware of. I think that most of us would know that some people faint when there's heat, but there are definitely other conditions that are in between. So tell me, how does heat really negatively affect the body? Because you're thinking you're just outside soaking in the sun, but what's really happening in the body when you are subjected to this heat illness?
So what's happening is that usually your body kind of adapts, what we call acclimatization, to different environments. As you know, you can walk into a room from outside that is really, really hot and walk into AC, and you will notice on your hands certain things happening. You will say, oh, all the hair is standing up on my body. You know, I start to shiver. There are different things that happen. For heat illness, there is what we like to call a disconnect between what we would expect to happen in the body when outside is hotter or your body temperature is hotter than, you know, so there's a disconnect between that and what normally happens. So your body has ways, you know, God in his infinite wisdom gave us ways to adjust to certain environments and certain things. And so there are many ways that our body adjusts to varying climate, varying temperatures. And then because we're talking about heat, our body can, you know, certain things can happen to help our body get rid of heat, which is not the same thing as a fever, to be very clear. So, you know, your brain kind of senses that certain things are happening around the body and responds in certain ways. So one of the things that people will often say is, oh my gosh, I'm sweating. And that's your body's way of allowing for the processes to kind of work. So you have, you know, if anybody did physics and chemistry and, you know, all the fancy words of convection and radiation and conduction, all these fancy terms just means that there are different ways for your body to try to cool itself. And that's actually how the different forms of heat illness actually would manifest or show themselves to a doctor when you go to be examined.
Right. So what you're really dealing with is the failure of the body to properly cool itself, regulate the temperature in the way that it normally would.
Correct.
Right. So you have a failure in those systems. So then obviously the follow-up question, what increases your risk of developing heat illness? Like, who are those persons who might be at risk?
Okay. So there are a number of things that can actually increase your risk of heat illness. And there are some things that you can change or modify, and there's some things that you can't. So for persons over 65 years of age, that's one of the things that you really can't modify, your age. Your obesity is unfortunately one of the predisposing factors to heat illness. And then there are other things that would kind of predispose to having heat illness. So, you know, taking certain medications, like things that you can buy over the counter, would be like Benadryl or Unisom, which are what we call antihistamines, anticholinergics. Certain types of psychiatric medications, then you're in your occupation. So persons who work in the, you know, who are military, who work in outdoor construction, marathon runners, those are certain occupations that will kind of predispose to having heat illness.
Yeah, and I just want to make it clear, I know that you would have heard that certain medications can predispose you to having heat illness, but we don't want you to stop taking your medication in fear that you're going to drop down out in the sun. Just let's make that very clear, because as we go on in the program, we are going to outline ways that you can protect yourselves. But yes, these are some of the factors that you would have mentioned, Dr. Arthur, that can predispose persons to heat illnesses. So how commonly do heat illnesses occur? Are there any statistics, whether locally, internationally? Is this really a problem that we need to be discussing?
Interestingly, heat illness is the most common environmental disorder. But in terms of actual numbers locally, I can't say to you that it is something that, you know, we would have recorded data on. And the reason for that is because of the spectrum of illness. So a lot of the times, people that have a heat rash will not usually go to a doctor. So the statistics on that will be a little bit skewed. But heat illness is the most common environmental disorder that there is.
Yeah, so something that is very important for us to know about, I would imagine. Yeah,
correct.
So we talked about the spectrum. So now I just want to zero in on each of these entities that we can give our listeners some useful information. Tell us a little bit about the heat rash. What is that looking like? You know, just give us a little bit of information about that.
Okay, I can guarantee you that every person in life has had a heat rash at some point. Even if you don't know it, your mom will say, you know, there's a heat rash. So usually in places where, you know, you have your sweat glands that may be blocked, you tend to get this, depending on your hue, this redness, this raised rash that may or may not itch. Some persons will see it along their neckline, under their arms, in their groin. And they will usually say, oh my gosh, when outside it's hot, I tend to get a rash. And interestingly enough, you would usually hear a person say, well, just put powder on it. But that is not the treatment. And talcum powder should not be used on a heat rash. Usually you will find it in persons who, you know, have thicker than usual clothing. So like police officers, when they have on their heavy bulletproof vests for the whole day and that's pressing on their skin, you'll find persons will then say, okay, well, I have a rash thereafter and it's itching. What do I do? It's kind of hard to tell you to change at work. So the usual thing would be, you know, just to have cool showers. Some persons will recommend light lotion. Sometimes they may have in chlorhexidine or hibiscus. People know that little pink liquid that is usually sold to clean the body or to clean cuts. That's some of the easier things to use to help combat the heat illness, but powder should not be used.
Oh, dear. Dr. Arthur, you can have some people throwing some rotten mangoes at us. How you mean to don't put the talcum powder on the baby? What are you talking about? These young doctors feel they know everything. But yes. So we don't recommend powder for the heat rash. If there's one thing that you take away, I'm sure that some people remember that, hopefully. Are there any complications of heat rash? Anything that we really have to be worried about when it comes to heat rash?
The most common thing that one should worry about is to have the rash turning into an infection. Mm-hmm. So usually if you for some reason can't get the good hygiene in, I can't bathe regularly, the chlorhexidine is not something that I can get. The thing to look out for are signs of your skin becoming infected. And so what does that look like if it doesn't look like a rash? You may start to see a yellow or white discharge coming from the area. So what people will may say, oh, this looks like pus. It may change color. It may become very sore. Those are some of the things that you need to look out for when your skin is becoming infected. It may get redder or hotter than usual. And those are some of the things to look out for. That's the main complication, a bacterial infection from the rash.
Yeah. And I think at that point, especially, that's when you really need to see your doctor. Because some people are very tempted to just go to the pharmacist and, you know, show them the rash and get something for it. But anytime that you have a rash that is infected, you need to see a physician. You need to see medical personnel to help you to deal with that. So I just want to put that out there. So we talked about heat rash. You mentioned some of the things to do in terms of treatment. Any tips for prevention, Dr. Arthur? Do you think this is preventable or is just a part of life and you just need to know how to deal with it?
I mean, it depends on the cause, because remember, it may, if your cause of getting heat illness is your environment, mm-hmm. and that's something that you can change. So if it is that, okay, for example, I'm into construction and I know that I'm going to work from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. And we know that that's, the sun is hottest between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. Is it something that, you know, we can come together as a team and say, we should either work earlier, pause during the hot times, work a bit later? Is it something that I can change my clothes frequently? I, you know, bring a change of clothes, and at lunchtime I change my shirt just so that it's not, you know, that soaked or drenched heavy material on me. Can I change my, the material of my clothes altogether? Mm-hmm. Use, you know, light cotton, breezy material. And then showering, minimum of twice a day, cool showers, just to be able to have my body clean.
Good. So you've given us quite a few tips, actually. I like the one about the materials that you're wearing, looking to see how you can adjust those. So we talked about heat rash. I want us to talk a little bit then about heat cramps.
Okay. All right, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you. Were you about to say something?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so heat cramps. Basically, it's a, well, we all know what a cramp is, when your muscles tend to contract, can be very painful. A lot of the times people will feel it in their calves or, you know, in their hands. You would normally see that happening when the muscles are tired. So the muscles mm-hmm. that would mostly get tired would be like your thigh muscles, your calf muscles, if you're exerting yourself, usually seen in persons running or doing other activities. And that is usually during the first days of doing a change in activity mm-hmm. or a change in temperature. So it usually takes your body about 7 to 14 days. So 1 to 2 weeks to acclimatize to an area. So for those people who are coming from nice Canada, that's -0 degrees, you're coming mm-hmm. to wonderful Barbados, that's 27, 30 degrees Celsius. In the first few days, your body's going a little haywire as it's trying to adjust. And during that time is, you know, persons are on vacation and they're like, yes, out to all. Let me go to the beach. Let me go to the bus crawl. Let me go to every fete. And then they will find that as they exert themselves, they tend to get these cramps in varying areas that can be very, very painful. Mm-hmm. It's usually a short period of time that you get the cramps for. They go away and then they may come back when you start your activity. So how do I prevent that? Mm-hmm. Most of the times when you're taking vacation, your vacation is 1 to 2 weeks. So I can't wait 1 to 2 weeks to acclimatize. But I can go slow and go steady. Make sure that I am taking in as much fluid, because, you know, alcohol, quote unquote, dry you out. Mm-hmm. Bring in my water. I need to take not just water, but my electrolytes. So Powerade, Gatorade, Pedialyte. Some people really do like Pedialyte. Tastes really good.
some people sounds like you, but go ahead.
It's a good trick to it too. You can actually put it in ice, in your ice trays, and get little ice cubes out of it. It's really, really refreshing. Whichever beverage you choose. But, you know, not just taking in alcohol, but making sure that you don't just take in water as well, but you take in your electrolytes and try to help your body in that way.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to point out, you talked about persons who are changing climates, but you also talked about initiating a new activity. So, like, would this apply, for example, to children who are going into summer camps where they're going to be outdoors a lot, whether it be a sports camp, or perhaps adults that know catch themselves and realize, wait, but I about to jump in a two-piece and the body ain't right, so I go in and join a boot camp. You know, we do these things around this time of year. Are they at risk of having these heat cramps that you're talking about?
That actually brings me to point out the difference between heat cramp and a condition called rhabdomyolysis, which is something that can actually happen when you overexert yourself and do these rapid, quick, you know, let me get into shape kind of things. And that rhabdomyolysis is, you know, breakdown of muscle. Mm-hmm. Whereas the heat cramp is, you know, you're losing water, you're losing electrolytes. Heat cramp is not as serious as rhabdomyolysis. Rhabdomyolysis is something that can actually kill you if you do not get the proper attention. But the concept is the same. You don't want to do things quickly. Interesting that you say about camp, because my son is about to start a football camp. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I thought about. How do you get him to, you know, get the benefits of running around all day in the sun, but not get sick? So some of the things that you can do for your, again, yes, they have their bottled water. Yes, they go to the tap, but you can pack in the Powerades and the Gatorades as well. Try to intermix that with the usual hydration that you would get, and even try to increase that. So instead of sending one bottle of water, you send them with two, things like that. For the gym, slow and steady. If not, summer will take the body that I have.
Yeah. All right. So we have our first caller for the night. Caller, good evening. Welcome to
Bella. Yes, hi, good evening. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Oh, wonderful. That's great. Well, you know, more than need a touch from you, more than all of my blessings come from you, and you have more than touched me with your presence. I want to multiply some blessings to the program. I wanted to ask a couple of questions. This is a very interesting topic. Know that there's been a record in the world for heat in terms of temperature, Celsius or Fahrenheit, depending on if you choose to use that or not. And in terms of here in Barbados, it's really, really hot, hotter than ever. And, you know, heat mixed with humidity is my first question. In terms of which one would be the worst out for going to the beach, sunstroke, heat stroke, or heat exhaustion? Which one would be more likely to be placed there? My second question is for the course of, we live in the tropics, and this is the closest to the equator as well, and Barbados is poised for what we would know as El Nino, which is the opposite of La Nina, which is the weather condition, climatic condition that deals with heat. And if there is heat not only coming from the sun, mention heat stroke, heat all around us, and heat coming from the earth, the good doctor mentioned conduction and convection and so on, and radiation. We have that more than ever here concentrated in Barbados. What are some of the things that we can do to cool down in the most effective and efficient ways as possible? You know, we don't want to come outside from plane being hot and go and take a cold shower and catch the cold. Or we don't want to stand up in the sun at midday. Yes, you got your vitamin D, but at the same time, you walk back into the air conditioning office after paying that bill and you're getting problems. And my final question, thank you very much, is, and thank the production for taking my call. Now, in terms of the medications that deal with blood thinning or even blood thickening, we know there are iron supplements and so on that deal with blood thickening, and Daflon and the others that deal, especially the blood pressure medications, the statins that deal with blood thinning. In relation to inside the body, now heat coming from inside the body, if the blood is thinner or thicker, does the viscosity of the blood have a relationship, or is it juxtaposed to the amount of heat that we actually feel? Because you know I don't want to mention fever, but you can have a situation where you're actually feeling hotter than you are, but outside is, yes, maybe humid, but it's not actually hot with the heat that will kill you or exhaust you or indeed even cause, as we were just talking about, heat cramps. So I just wanted to ask that. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. Have a good night.
All right. Thanks, you caller. It seems that you are reading our mind, because the first two questions that you asked are questions that we're actually going to address a little bit later in the program. So thanks so much for your contribution. But that last question about the viscosity of the blood, Dr. Arthur, I'm going to throw that to you.
It's actually an interesting question. To answer it in layman terms, because you thank you for your question, caller, but you put a lot of things out there that most people may or may not understand. So a lot of the times, the medications that we prescribe, like you would have, you know, alluded to, first of all, iron does not thicken the blood. That was a misconception. So iron does not thicken the blood. Iron supplements are used to help your body to make new blood cells. So every 120 days, unless you have something like sickle cell disease, your body's making new blood cells. And so iron supplements are there to help in that process. So it doesn't thicken the blood. With regards to things like aspirin, and I think he would have mentioned statins, the way how those drugs work, they really don't have an effect on your body's ability to cool itself. What happens is if you have something like atherosclerosis, which is, you know, plaques within the walls of the blood vessels, then that can have an effect on your body's ability to cool because the blood cannot pass around the body as freely as it should. That is something different to the medication. So the medications do not cause your blood to slow down. It doesn't cause your blood to speed up going around your body. But if you have like diabetes or, like I said, the same atherosclerosis, which comes with age, it kind of prevents the blood from going to the peripheries or the legs and the hands and the skin so that it can cool. It can be cooled as it makes its way around the body. I hope I didn't confuse you with that explanation. And I hope that was clear. But if it wasn't, please let me know.
Yes, I'm hoping that it was clear as well. I think in essence, what you're saying is that the effect of these conditions on the arteries really is what causes any effects on heating or cooling of the body as opposed to the medication. So right. You're looking at the disease process causing effects on cooling and heating rather than the medication. And we want to make that clear because, again, we never want to put information out there that causes persons to stop taking the medication out of fear. Yeah? So, yeah, very important information there. Now, the caller did mention heat exhaustion and heat stroke. And I want us to talk a little bit about heat exhaustion. In a similar way to what you would have described, how you would have talked about the others before. And then I want you to tell us about this heat sinker because it sounds so fancy, but I want you to break it down for our callers so that they understand. So I'll start with heat exhaustion. Can you tell us a little bit about that as we go along the spectrum?
Well, because we're going along the spectrum, I actually would rather tackle heat syncope because that's usually first on this before heat exhaustion. So you would then, so you know, if we're going along the line, you would get the heat rash, heat cramps, something called heat edema, so your legs swell, then heat syncope, heat exhaustion, and then heat stroke. That's the continuum. I'm not saying that you must have one in order for the other to happen, but in terms of severity and the continuum of disease, heat syncope, which is, syncope is a fancy term for fainting, right? So you were here, oh my gosh, I gone in the sun and in the fullest Beijing that I could possibly get, I drop down. Oh Lord, every time I go in the sun, I just drop down. So what happens? What happens when I'm in the sun and I fall? Kind of like what the caller was asking about in terms of your blood flow. So what happens when my body, I'm hot. I'm really, really hot. My temperature is getting up there to 40 because in some marathon runners, it can actually get up to 42 degrees Celsius, their body temperature. And they're still on their feet and they're running. And that's because they're accustomed to it. But for you, Kia, or me, Lord forbid, we get up all the way up there. All our body is going to be like, pause, 3 seconds. Something needs to happen. What happens is that our blood vessels open up so that our blood flows again to the skin so that it can have a way of cooling itself. You can't have it both ways. If the blood is flowing to the skin, where the blood to the brain going, and your body's main thing is to protect itself. Your body will protect the brain before it protects any other part of your body. And so if the brain is not getting enough blood, bring it on. You will fall flat. You will go flat, and when you go flat, your body will reset itself. Blood flow goes back to the brain. You're good to go again.
Right. So in terms of heat syncope, how long can these episodes last?
Well, the definition of syncope is a brief loss of consciousness. Brief, usually less than 1 minute. Anytime you find that somebody's on the floor and they're out for more than a minute, smelling salts usually is not going to help. We want to check to see if they have a pulse. Right? Does this person have a pulse? Do I need to start CPR? And do I call 511? So, yes, it's usually a very short loss of consciousness that this person is going to have. They may not be able to sit up in time. And that's one of the other things that you will find that the lay persons would want to come and do. Oh my gosh, she dropped down, picked she up. No. Allow the person to quote unquote catch themselves. Give them give them some time. You may elevate their feet. So lift your foot up. Not to expose if it's a lady in a dress. You don't want to expose her. But you lift the legs up, get that blood flow going. And fanning, in this instance, fanning will be a good thing because it helps with the cooling. Get that person. Make sure that they're fine, because sometimes when you fall down, you can hit your head really hard. Mm-hmm. And the older you are, the more serious that little head bump can be, because that can actually cause a bleed on the brain. So there are certain things that we may take for granted and say, they're fine, but they may still need to go to the hospital. Because the other thing is, these heat illnesses are what we call diagnoses of exclusion.
Right.
I don't want to go and say, oh, it was because outside hot that granny fell down, when granny actually had a heart attack. Mm-hmm. Or granny actually had a stroke. So these are things that we need to, not just granny, the young person too, because people tend to forget that young people can have heart attacks and strokes. People can have illnesses even though they are young. It's not, it's not unheard of. So yes, you may still need to go to the hospital. You need to get checked out. You need to get your heart checked. You may need to get your head checked for bleeds on the brain and making sure that you didn't have a stroke, stuff like that. Before we can say, it's heat syncope, you're free to go. But the layperson should not take it upon themselves to say, oh, say hot. Then just, them just faint because I'll say hot, because it may be something more serious.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you said that, Dr. Arthur, because the last thing that we want people to do is to go around self-diagnosing or diagnosing others. If somebody loses consciousness, that's always an indication, unless they have been previously diagnosed with a condition that is known to cause them to lose consciousness, and the episode is exactly how you would expect it. Anybody that loses consciousness should be assessed medically by a medical professional. Yes, I think. And that you said the smelling salts and the other strange things that we do, the best thing is to get that person help as soon as possible. So really, really good points coming out there. Are we worried about heat syncope long term? Is there anything that we have to worry about? If you had one episode, is there anything that you have to worry about long term?
Well, the best thing about having anything happen to you is hindsight. Hindsight is 20/20. So usually you can look back, and most times people can pinpoint, this is what happened. So I had on 15 jackets and five pants at this time, and I was really hot. Let me not do that again. You can usually pinpoint things that were not ideal that you can kind of change so that this doesn't happen in the future. But for heat syncope, once it's truly just heat syncope, it's self-limiting. So you're unlikely to continue happening unless you put yourself in a similar situation again. But like I said, once it's only heat syncope, because remember, loss of consciousness or syncope can have many causes, and we want to make sure that those life-threatening or urgent things are ruled out before we say, oh, it was just heat syncope.
Great. I want to tell us then a little bit, I think we jumped past heat edema, didn't we?
Yeah, yes. We did.
I want you to tell us a little bit about heat edema before we move on to heat exhaustion and heat stroke. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Okay, so within the body, there are varying pressures, varying things that can keep your blood going in the right direction. So usually your veins, the job of your veins is to take the blood back to the heart. When you are in a hot environment, as we just said, your blood vessels, what we call dilate, they open up, and it allows the blood to come closer to the surface to be cooled. The problem with your blood vessels opening up is that the blood in your legs then is having a harder time to get back to the heart. And so those pressures would cause your legs to look swollen. And one of the things that people tend to say immediately, oh my gosh, my leg is swollen. I want some medication to make me urinate more. I want some medication in Bayesian terms to make me pee more so I can take down the swelling. That's not going to work here. Compression stockings, if it is something that's happening, you know, on a day-to-day basis, may help. But usually once you sit and put the legs up, the swelling would go away. And persons will say to you again, hindsight is 20/20. This usually only happens when I'm very hot, or this usually happens when only when outside is very hot. So taking that history, that story from the person, kind of helps piece together, you know, what could possibly be the cause of your foot swelling. Because for things that would require the water tablets, as people will put that, there's little that you can do on your own to make that swelling go down. And there's usually a very specific cause, and that's why the doctor would prescribe the medication in that instance. But not every swollen foot requires the water tablets.
Yeah, and you know, people do go to the pharmacy and ask for these things, and it's very dangerous if you take what we call Lasix, or these water tablets, and you don't need them. You can dehydrate yourself, you can cause kidney damage, so it's very dangerous to do that. The other thing, Dr. Arthur, I wanted to point out is that with the swelling of the legs, you know, perhaps you should be assessed by a medical professional, because they're very serious conditions that can cause swelling of the legs, like heart conditions, heart failure. And then you also have your venous diseases in general. That
the clots and the clots in the legs.
Absolutely, absolutely. Blood clots in the legs. So if you do have swollen legs, yes, it could be heat edema, but it might not be. So again, we encourage you, get yourself checked. So if you're seeing it, especially more than once, you want to get that checked just to be sure. Yeah.
And also if it's only, you know, one of the things to point out, if only one of your legs is swollen.
Yes, yes.
Chances are it's not heat edema, and you really should get that checked.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of the things that you could be dealing with, a blood clot in the legs. That one leg that's swollen, that's warm, that's red and angry. So yes, you definitely should get that checked. So we talked about a number of things. I want to remind our callers this evening, we are speaking about heat illnesses because we understand at this time of year, a lot of people are out in the sun. And so if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to contact us at 434-1790. That's 434-1790. Or you can send your WhatsApp messages through to 266-4862. 266-4862. We have Dr. Latonya Arthur on with us this evening, an emergency physician, and she would be more than happy to take your calls. So far, we've covered quite a bit, but we still are yet to speak about heat exhaustion and about heat strokes. So I'm wondering, Dr. Arthur, can you tell me a little bit about heat exhaustion?
Okay, so heat exhaustion, again, on the spectrum of illness, is usually by volume depletion under conditions of heat stress. So usually exertional, you know, persons who would have been working really, really hard, I guess trying to get something, a task completed in the midday sun, persons who are marathon runners, or could be as simple as somebody's coming from a climate that they're not accustomed to and then going into doing these games. So they're sweating a lot more. Water is gone from their body. They're not hydrating enough. So yet they get what we call water depletion. And you will find them saying, oh my gosh, I don't feel well. They usually express that, I don't feel well. You come to the medical tent, you assess the person, or to the doctor, assess the person, and you recognize that, you know, they look dry. So what does that mean to the general public? What does a doctor say when you look dry? You know, you'll see the doctor telling you all the time, look up, they're looking in your eyes, open your mouth, they're looking in your mouth. What are they really doing? They're looking to see, amongst other things, how hydrated you are, And you will find that as a person becomes more dehydrated, they tend to look dry. When you open your mouth, you don't see your saliva in the mouth, that your tongue is not as nicely coated. Everything looks dry and starts to get cracked, or the skin becomes very, very dry and you kind of look crispy. those are some of the things that you're looking for persons who, again, are on Lasix or other what we call diuretics. They tend to be then depleted in certain salts. So you can have water depletion or salt depletion, and then that person becomes exhausted. They're tired. You assess them, of course, as we would for anything else. But then, you know, the additional thing here may be that they may need intravenous fluids. So you get what people would like to say is a needle in the ham. It's not really a needle. It's plastic. We put the needle in, the plastic in, and we give you fluids through the bag that's dripping. It's not a willy-nilly thing about how many fluids you get. It's going to be based on your weight and how dehydrated you appear to be. And you usually can go home once you are rehydrated again.
Great. So I wanted to discuss then the difference between heat exhaustion and heat stroke.
Now, heat stroke is the mummy of these illnesses. This is the one that I don't really care how experienced you think you are in first aid, you need to get the person to the hospital. So heat stroke usually comes with what we call altered mental status. This person is now behaving like they cannot be controlled. They may be having hallucinations. So they're looking at you, Dr. Lewis, and they're seeing the green men over your head, or they may be hearing things that are not there. Or they may have a seizure, go into a coma. And when you test their body temperature is greater than 40.5 degrees Celsius. This person is having a heat stroke. It is a medical emergency and it is life-threatening.
Yeah.
Do not put a spoon in their mouth if they're having a seizure. Do not try to put any sugar in their mouth. Do not try to put anything in their mouth, not even your finger. Turn them on a side, call the ambulance, and get them to the hospital.
And then once they get to the hospital, what really is done for people that are having heat strokes?
Depending on the institution that you go to, some persons would actually immerse the person in an ice bath. So some people actually have a tub full of ice and water, and they will put the person down in that ice bath as they are trying to cool them. But in emergency medicine, we do nothing until we assess the person's airway, breathing, and circulation. So just like how you have ABCs in primary school, we have ABCs in emergency medicine. If that person's airway is not secure, we will do what we need to do to secure the airway. So you may find that the person may need to get a tube down their throat so we can breathe for them. That's airway and breathing. Then circulation-wise, you may find that, there are certain things that we're doing. So why the doctor don't just hurry up? We need to know what the blood pressure is. We need to know what the pulse rate is. We need to know what our blood sugar is. And we also may have somebody coming to you as the bystander or as the relative to ask certain really quick questions. Does this person have thyroid disease? Because there are other things that can manifest as heat stroke. Does this person have thyroid disease? Does this person have a psychiatric illness and is taking medication that, so another life-threatening illness, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, serotonin syndrome. There are certain things that you'll find that people are asking. So we're not just asking you because we want to be all up in your business. We're trying our best in that moment to try to figure out what is happening and how we can help. In the absence of the ice bath, we can do the fan. You can put ice packs in the groin and under the armpits. Cooled intravenous fluid. So the same bag, you'll find that that may be cooled as we're getting that fluid in the body as ways of trying to cool that person down and manage what is happening. Now, in all of this, you may see, oh my gosh, the doctor is taking blood. Why are you taking so many different things? Because we want to know what's happening inside. And we can only know what's happening inside if we send the blood to the lab. You know, we're looking to see what your kidneys are doing. We're looking to see what your liver is doing. As the caller would have pointed out, some people may have clotting issues or they may have no issues, but we're also looking to see, is your blood going to clot? They're all, you know, these are all the things that we're going to be looking for as we're trying to treat you for this life-threatening illness.
And I just want us to make the distinction, because there's a term heat stroke, and I'm thinking that so many people think, you know, this is the same thing as a normal stroke, what we would normally know as a stroke, except that it's caused by heat. Can you make a distinction there for us, Dr. Arthur?
I think people will say that because some of the things are similar in that the person may act differently, what we call change in mental status. But a stroke itself, there are two different types. Right. There's a bleed on the brain, and there's a clot in the brain. And those things are usually, except for a very specific treatment, usually not reversible, just like that. You may or may not see on the CAT scan of the brain the stroke, the regular cerebrovascular accident or stroke, but with the heat stroke, what you will notice is, like I said, in the blood results, their liver, the liver function tests, the different transaminases are likely to be deranged. That's usually not the case in a quote unquote regular stroke. You will find that the persons with a regular stroke would not have kidney issues just because of that, you know, event. They may have predisposing kidney problems, but not acute kidney problems. And yes, we can often interpret that by looking at your results if something is likely to be now or a long-standing issue. So heat stroke is usually, again, coming with that temperature of 40.5 and higher, whereas a regular stroke, and again, I'm using that term loosely, regular stroke, your temperature is normal. You know, you don't have any of these things happening. You are not, yes, you may have been outside, but the story is going to be a bit different.
Right.
You must in on, you know, which is the thing that's happening now, what we need to treat.
Right. And I know that there are a lot of long-term effects of the regular stroke. So that leads me to the question, are there long-term effects for a heat stroke? Because this is, like we said, a different condition altogether. Are there long-term effects for a heat stroke or complications?
Again, usually for these illnesses, they're reversible. So unless, I'm trying to think of an instance where it can be a long-term effect. Unless something happens when you're having heat stroke. So for example, you may have, you know, struck your head and something else happened. Then I'm going to say no. The heat stroke itself,
Right. Okay. Fantastic. So earlier in the program, you gave some really good recommendations for parents who want to kind of protect their children as they're running around in the sun. And I just want to make it clear, we're not trying to fearmonger. So we're not saying the average child is going to have a heat stroke or even heat fatigue. So they're very specific persons who are more likely to have. This does not mean that anybody can't have a heat stroke, but like we said earlier in the program, they're very specific persons that are more likely to have these conditions. Okay, so we have a caller. I was about to ask a question, but we have a caller. Welcome, caller, to Better Health.
Yes, thank you very much. Good evening. The good doctor, Dr. Arthur, would have wanted to know if that particular situation that she was talking about, based on the question that I had asked, if I had understood, and yes, I do understand that what you explained, Dr. Lewis. So, a very quick question: what is now that we're in the time of crop over, and I want to thank you for asking my question. And there's great heat in Barbados. I'm asking, if we can do more activities like late in the evening or at night because of the great heat that you would get, actually the instances of heat stroke and heat exhaustion and sunstroke because of the sun and because of the exertion that we do during the day. Now, as we finish with the actual going out with the sun and doing our activities, I'm asking, is the evening in terms of getting in more water, as we've seen that many even prime ministers have been dehydrated because of it, that we should indeed have more water intake based on doing more activities that night. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your question. Let me just caution, because you just brought up really, too much water is a thing, huh? Water toxicity is also a thing. So as with anything in life, it's about balance. Now, your recommendation for having events into the afternoon and night is a really good one. But we know that people also like breakfast parties. What I've noticed is that the only thing that you really have to worry about in terms of high sun is Kadumat Day, because people will be out when the sun is at, is kicking. from very early in the morning till late at night is Kadumat, is an all-day event. Kadumat is also mixed with a lot of alcohol intake, which can further dehydrate you. So balance. It's not just water, but things with electrolytes. If you don't like Powerade, for example, water it down. Gatorade, Powerade. And again, the Pedialyte. Let's plug in the plug for the Pedialyte. Pedialyte's not just for the children. If you like it, they have different flavors as well. You can also utilize that. But it's a good point to note about having the events in the evening, but it's not just the actual sun. It's the environment. So you can have an event at night, but you can still be very hot. You can have persons who are bundled, are, you know, close together, close environment. Everything is hot. I have on a lot of clothes. And drinking alcohol, that's a recipe for disaster. So it's all about balance and what you're doing and when.
And I just wanted to add there, Dr. Arthur, I know there are some parents who, you know, who might be a little bit concerned about using certain energy drinks because of the sugar content. You know, they might be watching that sugar content, maybe advised by a doctor or, you know, otherwise. And so for those parents, one of the things that we recommend, coconut water is actually excellent. You will get your hydration, you get your electrolytes in. And really for adults, you know, coconut water is really good if you want to get some electrolytes in. Some people will get a bottle of water, add a little bit of salt and a little bit of lime, things like that, so that you can naturally get your electrolytes and you don't have to get the sugars. So for those of you who are watching your sugar intake, there are alternatives. You can look up online natural ways to make those electrolyte mixes. Just make sure that you're not adding any strange chemicals that you don't know anything about. So I just wanted to slip that in there really, really quickly.
And also make sure that when you do look up the recipes that you don't try to modify it. You may not get it right and you may end up doing more harm than good.
Than good, absolutely. Now, I want you, Dr. Arthur, to make some quick recommendations. I know that you are the owner of a daycare in Barbados, which is so unusual. And we're actually going to ask you to come back on, Dr. Arthur, because we want parents to know you are an emergency physician. And I know safety is a big thing for you. How do you have your children in a daycare setting and make sure that they are safe? We want parents and grandparents, as they're looking to send children to nurseries, to daycares, and even to primary schools, to know what they should be looking out for in terms of safety, in terms of health. And we also want persons who are interested, who own daycares, are interested in owning daycares, teachers, educators on a whole, to know about the safety precautions that they should be taking with a daycare. So Dr. Arthur, we're really going to invite you back to the program a little closer to back to school to discuss that. In the interim though, give us some recommendations for persons who own daycares or may have summer camps and they want to do a lot of outdoor activity. We're pushing the outdoor activity. We know that we have a serious problem with childhood obesity here in Barbados. We always hear these statistics. So we want children to be out and about during the summer. We don't want them to be indoors watching screens and eating down the place. But we want them to do that safely. So are there any recommendations that you would give to summer camp owners or daycare owners in terms of how they can provide that protection, how they can structure activities so that it is still safe for the children to enjoy?
Sure. One of the things that I would always advocate is movement. But this is where the parents and the daycare owners or the teachers need to know, come together and agree. Because parents, when you're packing that bag for school, think about the environment. Think about, okay, do I need to have sleeveless things? Do I need to have the dry fit material? Is it a case where I'm going to pack, instead of one extra suit of clothes, two, so that the aunties can change the children if they go outside and become extremely soaked from sweating? Then, you know, the aunties are the health, the daycare provider or school provider can also gauge, okay, I am going to let you go outside for X period of time. We're not going to be out there for 3 or 4 or 5 hours in one go, but we can go outside and have an activity for half an hour, come back inside, make sure the children are well hydrated, and, you know, intersperse your indoor and outdoor activities so that they're not outside for prolonged periods. And then sunblock. Mummies, daddies, there's sunblock for children. Make sure that you have, you protect their skin as well, because yes, we want to get that vitamin D in, we want to get them moving, but we don't want to overexpose them. And children love to run around. So let's not hinder that.
Yeah, absolutely. Sun protection is really important, not just for children, but for adults. Another thing that they might look at is having outdoor activities in a shaded area wherever possible. So if you're outdoors, you may have an area where you have some trees or a shed or whatever. Consider having your activities. You know, there's this thing, old people feel like the sun good for you. So the more sun, the harder it can make the child. And so they feel like, you know, yeah, there's a big shadow there that you could be using, but no, you're going out in the middle of the field. That's where you're having the activity.
Yeah, because right? It's going to make you tired.
Right? But we want to say to people, yeah, the sun is good in moderation, but we live in the sun, for goodness sake. When they walk into wherever, they get enough sun. So wherever possible, let them enjoy their activities in the shade. You talked about sunscreen. I want you to give some tips for the adults that are going to be at the parties, are just going to be working out during the summer. What tips would you give to them in terms of protecting themselves? And I know that you mentioned a few, but just to wrap up the program, what tips would you give to them as well?
Interestingly enough, I find that nowadays the women do not leave for a party unless they have a fan. I love to see that. Yes. So that's the trend. So if you are not on it, Dr. Lewis, you need to get your little hand fan for when you go to these events. Right? I felt very out of place the other day when I went to my one and only crop-up event. I seem to be the only person without a fan. But that's a good thing, because they're not overheating. Alcohol intake in moderation. Make sure you are getting in your fluids. Again, you don't have to party in the full sun. Find a shady spot. Even if you want to see your artist performing, everybody loves to see Hypersounds now. You want to go see Mr. Hypersounds performing. You don't need to do so in the direct sunlight. You know, pick a spot, pick an area. You can still have fun, but do it responsibly.
Right, absolutely. And then for older persons with chronic illnesses and all of these medications, whether they're going out themselves, because we have a lot of very independent older persons, or whether it's somebody who's taking them out, what tips would you give to them?
So it's always good to know what that person is taking, because like I said, just because the person is having an emergency, it may not necessarily be related to the heat. I think more so than taking them out, we want to check in on them. So those independent old persons that we haven't seen in a while, who may be in the house locked away, they're exposed to the heat illnesses. And when we're taking them out, again, if you can take them out either in the early morning or in the afternoon, do so and make sure that they too are hydrated.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're wrapping up now, Dr. Arthur. It's been an absolute privilege to have you. Do you have any closing comments that you want to leave with our listeners? Anything that you want them to take away to remember about this particular topic of heat illnesses?
Yes, just to remember that it is a spectrum of disease. If you are unsure, get medical attention, and in everything, do so responsibly, everything in moderation. And if you have any questions or you're unsure about anything, speak to your doctor.
Thank you so much, Dr. Arthur. This has been Better Health. We were talking about heat illnesses this evening. We want you to protect yourselves as you go out into the sun, into this tropical paradise that we are fortunate to call home. So, Ronnie, it was great to have you. You were very quiet, but it was great to have you with us this evening. And to our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in with us. We look forward to having Better Health with you next week. God willing, wish you a wonderful week.
Fantastic program. And contrary to public rumor, I'm a very quiet individual. Have a wonderful Sunday.